You relaxed your hand, opened your fingers, and something flew away. I remember thinking, maybe that's all right. Out the window, through the swaying branches, I could see some stars. That picture has never escaped my memory. On the 12th, we put on our orange vests and orange hats, and into the woods we went. In the morning, we separated, getting together again for lunch and to compare notes, what we'd seen and what we hadn't. That first day, we met back at the cabin, and I made a big pot of pasta with cheese and half a pound of bacon. I called this Hungarian goulash, but any self-respecting Hungarian would have taken one look and covered his eyes. That afternoon, we hunted together. The next day, we ate a picnic lunch in a clearing, looking across the creek, which was more like a river that day, at Nellie Bell. Butch made sandwiches, which he could be trusted to do. There was sweet water from our well to drink, and hostess fruit pies for afters, blueberry for me, apple for Butch. "Did you see any deer?" Butch asked, licking frosting from his fingers. "Well, those fruit pies aren't exactly frosted, but they have a glaze that's quite tasty." "Nope. Not today, not yesterday, but you know what the old-timers say. The deer know when November comes, and they hide." "I actually think that could be true," Butch said. "They do have a tendency to disappear after Halloween. But what about gunshots? Heard any?" I thought it over. "A couple yesterday, none today." "Are you going to tell me we're the only hunters in the 30 Mile? "Christ, no. The woods between here and Dark Score Lake are probably the best hunting in the county, you know that. I saw a couple of guys this morning, not long after I started out, although they didn't see me. I think one of them might have been that nummy Freddy Skillins, the one who likes to call himself a carpenter." He nodded. "I was over on that Humpback Ridge, and I saw 3 men on the other side, dressed like models from L.L. Bean's and carrying scoped rifles. Just about had to be out of status. And for every one we see, there's probably 5 or 10 more. There should be plenty of bang-bang, because not all the deer decided to up stakes and head for Canada, did they?"
"Seems unlikely," I said.
"The deer are out there, Butchie."
"Then why haven't we seen them? And listen."
"What am I supposed to be listening for?"
"Just shut up a minute, and you'll hear it. By which I mean you won't."
I shut up. I heard the Gelassi roaring away, no doubt undercutting the bridge supports, even as we sat there on the grass munching the last of our fruit pies. I heard the far-off drone of an airplane, probably bound for the Portland jetport. Otherwise, nothing. I looked at Butch. He was looking at me and not smiling. Solemn.
"No birds," I said.
"No, and the woods should be full of them." Just then a crow gave out a single loud call.
"There you go," I said, and actually felt relieved.
"One crow," he said. "Big deal. Where are the robins?"
"Flown south?"
"Not yet. Not all of them. We should be hearing nuthatches and cardinals. Maybe a goldfinch and chickadees galore. But there's not even a fucking woodpecker."
I usually ignore the soundtrack of the woods, you get used to it. But now that he mentioned it, where were the birds? And something else.
"The squirrels," I said. "They should be running around everywhere, getting ready for winter. I think I've seen a couple..."
I trailed off because I wasn't even sure of that.
"It's aliens," Butch said in a low joke spooky voice. "They could be creeping toward us through the woods right now with their disintegrator, ray guns."
"You saw that story in The Call," I said. "The one about the flying saucer."
"Wasn't a saucer. It was a cigar," Butch said. "A flying cigar."
"The Tipperillo that came from Planet X," I said.
"With a lust for Earth women."
We looked at each other and snickered.
I had an idea for a story that afternoon. Much later, it became a novel called The Terrible Generation. and I was making some notes in one of my spiral notebooks that evening. I was trying to think of a good name for the villainous young man at the heart of the story when the cabin door banged open and Butch ran in.
"Come here, Leah. You have to see this."
He grabbed his camera.
"See what?" "Just come."
I looked at his wide eyes, put aside my notebook, and followed him out the door. While we walked a quarter mile to the clearing in a creek, he told me he'd come out to check if the bridge's tilt had increased. We would have heard it if it had collapsed entirely. Then he saw what was in the sky and forgot all about the bridge.
"Look," he said, when we got to the clearing, and pointed up. It had started to rain, just a gentle mist. It was full dark, and I shouldn't have been able to see the lowering clouds, but I could, because they were lit by slowly moving circles of bright light. 5, then 7, then 9. They were different sizes. The smallest was maybe 30 feet across. The biggest could have been 100. They weren't shining off the clouds the way a bright spotlight or a powerful flashlight will. They were in the clouds.
"What are they?" I asked, almost whispering. "I don't know, but they sure as shit aren't Tiburillos."
"Or white owls," I said, and we began to laugh. Not the way you do when something is funny, the way you do when you're absolutely gobsmacked with amazement. Butch took pictures. This was years before chip technology allowed for instant gratification, but I saw the prints later, after he developed them in his own little darkroom. They were disappointing. Just big circles of light above the dark jig-jags of the treetops. I have seen pictures of UFOs since then, or UAPs if you prefer, but they are usually disappointing. Blurry shapes that could be anything, including the trick photography of hoaxes. You had to be there to understand how wonderful it was and how weird. Great soundless lights moving in the clouds, seeming almost to waltz. What I remember most clearly, other than a sense of awe, was how divided my mind was during the 5 or 10 minutes it went on. I wanted to see what was making those lights, yet I didn't. I was afraid, you see, that we were close to artifacts, maybe even intelligent beings, from another world. That exalted me, but it also terrified me. Looking back on that first contact, for surely it was that, I think our only two choices were to laugh or to scream. If I'd been alone, I almost certainly would have screamed and run away, probably to hide under my bed like a child and deny I'd seen anything. Because we were together and grown men, we laughed. I say 5 or 10 minutes, but it might have been 15. I don't know. It was long enough for the drizzle to thicken into real rain. Two of the bright circles grew smaller and disappeared. Then 2 or 3 more went. The biggest stayed the longest. Then it also began to dwindle. It didn't move from side to side, simply shrank to the size of a plate, then a 50-cent piece, then a penny, then a brilliant dot, then gone, as if it had shot straight up. We stood there in the rain, waiting for something else to happen. Nothing did. After a little while, Butch grabbed my shoulder. I gave a squawk. "Sorry, sorry," he muttered. "Let's go in. Light show's over, and we're getting soaked."
That was what we did. I hadn't bothered to put on a jacket, so I built up the fire, which had been down to coals, and stripped off my wet shirt. I was rubbing my arms and shivering. "We can tell people what we saw, but they won't believe it," Butch said. "Or they'll shrug and say it was some crazy weather phenomenon."
"Maybe it was, or..." "How far away is the Castle Rock Airport?"
He shrugged. "Has to be 20 or 30 miles east of here."
"The runway lights. Maybe with the clouds. The moisture. It could, you know, some prismatic effect."
He was sitting on the couch, camera in his lap, looking at me, smiling just a little, saying nothing. He didn't have to.
"That's bullshit, isn't it?" I said.
"Yes. I don't know what that was, but it wasn't lights from the airport, and it wasn't a fucking weather balloon." There were 8 or 10 of those things, maybe a dozen, and they were big.
There are other hunters in the woods. I saw Freddy Skillins, and you saw 3 guys who were probably Flatlanders. They could have seen it.
Maybe they did, but I doubt it. I just happened to be in the right place, that clearing on the edge of the creek, at the right time. In any case, it's over. I'm going to bed.
It rained all the next day, the 14th that would have been. Neither of us wanted to go out and get soaked looking for deer we probably wouldn't find. I read and worked a little bit on the idea for my story. I kept trying to come up with a good name for the bad kid and didn't have any luck. Maybe because I didn't have a clear fix on why the bad kid was bad. Butch spent most of the morning with his pad. He drew 3 different pictures of the lights in the clouds, then gave up in disgust. I hope the photos come out because these suck, he said. I looked them over and told him they were good, but they weren't. They didn't suck, but they didn't convey the strangeness of what we'd seen, the enormity. I looked at all the crossed-out names of my proposed bad guy. Trig Adams. No. Vic Ellenby. No. Jack Claggett. 2 on the nose. Carter Cantwell. Oh, puke. The story I had in mind seemed amorphous. I had an idea, but no specifics, nothing to hold on to. It reminded me of what we'd seen the previous night. Something was there, but it was impossible to tell what, because it was in the clouds. What are you doing? Butch asked me. Fucking off. I think I'll take a nap. What about lunch? Don't want any. He considered this, then looked out the window at the steady rain. Nothing is colder than cold November rain. It crossed my mind that someone should write a song about it, and eventually someone did.
A nap sounds like just a ticket, Butch said. He put his pad aside and stood up.
Tell you something, Leah. I'm going to draw all my life, but I'll never be an artist.
The rain stopped around 4 o'clock that afternoon. By 6, the clouds had unraveled and we could see stars and a sliver of moon. God's fingernail, the old-timers say. We ate our steaks for dinner, along with plenty of Wonder Bread to sop up the juice, then went out to the clearing. We didn't talk about it, just went. We stood there for maybe 30 minutes, craning our necks. There were no lights, no saucers, no flying cigars. We went back inside. Butch found a pack of bicycles in the living room cabinet, and we played cribbage until almost 10 o'clock. I can hear the Jalassi even in here, I said, as we finished the last hand.
I know. That rain didn't do the bridge any help. Why is there a fucking bridge there anyway? Did you ever ask yourself that?
I think someone had an idea for development back in the 60s. Or pulpers. They must have clear-cut these woods back before World War I.
You think about hunting one more day and going back.
I had an idea he was thinking of more than going home, most likely empty-handed. Seeing those lights in the clouds had done something to him. Could have done something to both of us.
I'm not going to call it a come-to-Jesus moment. It's just that maybe you see something. Lights in the sky, or a certain shadow at a certain time of day, how it lies across your path. You take it as a sign and decide to move along. You say to yourself that when I was a child, I spoke as a child, understood as a child, thought as a child, but there comes a time to put away childish things. Or it could have been nothing.
Leah?
Sure. One more day, and we go back. I have to clean the gutters before the snow flies, and I keep putting it off.
The next day was cool and clear and perfect for hunting, but neither of us saw so much as a single flick of a single whitetail. I heard no bird song, just the occasional crow call. I kept an eye out for squirrels, but didn't see any. I didn't even see a chipmunk, and the woods should have been full of their scurry. I heard some gunshots, but they were far away, near the lake, and hunters shooting didn't mean they were shooting at deer. Sometimes guys get bored and just want to let off a round or two, especially if they've decided there's no game to scare away. We met back at the cabin for lunch, then went out together. We no longer expected to see deer, and we didn't, but it was a fine day to be outdoors. We walked along the creek for a mile or so, then sat on a fallen log and opened cans of Bud. "This just isn't natural," Butch said. "I don't care for it much. I'd say drive out this afternoon, but by the time we got loaded up, it'd be dark, and I don't trust Nellie Bell's headlights on those woods roads."
A sudden breeze kicked up, rattling leaves off the trees. The sound made me startle and look over my shoulder. Butch did, too. Then we looked at each other and laughed. "Jumpy much?" I asked.
"Just a little. Remember when we went in the old Spear place on a dare? 1946 or so, wasn't it?"
"I remember. Old man Spear came back from Okinawa missing an eye and blew his head off in his parlor with a shotgun. It was the talk of the town."
"The house was supposed to be haunted," I said. "We were, what, 13? "I guess. We went in and picked up some stuff to show our friends we'd been there."
"I got a picture. Some old landscape I grabbed off the wall. What did you get?"
"A fucking sofa cushion," he said and laughed. "Talk about stupid. I thought of the Spear house because the way I felt then is how I feel now. No deer, no birds, no squirrels. Maybe that house wasn't haunted, but these woods."
He shrugged and drank some of his beer. "We could leave today. Those headlights will probably be okay."
"No, tomorrow. We'll pack up tonight, go to bed early, and leave at first light, if it suits you."
"Suits me fine."
Things would have been very different for us if we trusted Nellie Bell's headlights. Sometimes I think we did. Sometimes I think there's a shadow Laird and a shadow Butch who led shadow lives. Shadow Butch never went to Seattle. Shadow Laird never wrote a novel, let alone a dozen of them. Those shadows were decent men who lived unremarkable hollow lives. They ran the dump, they owned a hauling company, they did the town's business the way it should be done, which means so the books balance at town meeting in March, and there's less bitching from mossbacks who'd be happy to bring back the poor farm. Shadow Butch got married to some girl he met in a Lewiston bop joint and had a litter of shadow youngins. I tell myself now it was good none of that happened. Butch told himself the same thing. I know, because we told each other when we talked on the phone or later via Skype or FaceTime. It was all good. Of course it was. We became famous. We became rich. Our dreams came true. Nothing wrong with those things. And if I ever have doubts about the shape of my life, doesn't everybody? Don't you? That night, Butch threw a bunch of leftovers into a pot and called the result stew. We ate it with Wonder Bread and washed it down with well water, which was really the best part of the meal. "I'll never let you cook again," I told Butch as we did our few dishes. "After that mess, I'll hold you to it," he said. We packed up what we had and put it by the door. Butch dealt the big first aid kit a sideways kick with one sneaker. "Why do we always bring this thing?" "Because Sheila insists. She's convinced one of us is going to fall in a sinkhole and break a leg, or one of us will get shot. Probably by a flatlander with a scoped rifle." "Bullshit. I think she's just superstitious. Believes the one time we don't haul it out here is the one time we'd need it. You want to go take another look?" I didn't have to ask what he meant. Might as well. We went down to the clearing to look at the sky. There were no lights up there, but there was something on the bridge. Or rather, someone. A woman, lying face down on the planks. "What the fuck?" Butch said and ran onto the bridge. I followed. I didn't like the idea of three of us on it at the same time and close together, but we weren't going to leave her lying there unconscious, maybe even dead. She had long black hair,
It was a breezy night, and I noticed that when the wind gusted, her hair blew in a clump, as if the strands had been glued together. There were no gauzy flyaways, just that clump.
"Grab her feet," Butch said. "We have to get her off before the fucking bridge falls into the fucking creek."
He was right. I could hear the supports groaning and the Jalassi thundering in full spate thanks to all the rain. I got her feet. She was wearing boots and corduroy pants, and there was something funny about them, too. But it was dark, and I was scared, and all I wanted right then was some solid ground under my feet. Butch lifted her by the shoulders and gave a cry of disgust.
"What?" I asked. "Never mind. Come on, hurry."
We got her off the bridge and into the clearing. Only 60 feet, but it seemed to take forever.
"Put it down, put it down. Jesus, Jesus Christ."
Butch dropped the top half of her, and she face-planted, but he paid no attention. He crossed his arms and started rubbing his hands in his armpits as if to get rid of something nasty. I started to put her legs down and froze, not able to believe what I thought I was seeing. My fingers appeared to have sunk into her boots as if they were made of clay instead of leather. I pulled free and stared stupidly at the marks of my fingers as they smoothed out. My God. It's like, fuck, like she's made out of Play-Doh or something.
Butch.
Wait. For Christ's sakes, what?
Her clothes aren't clothes. It's like body paint. Or camouflage, or some damn thing. He bent toward her.
"It's too dark. Have you got
a flashlight?"
"No, didn't bring it. Her hair."
I touched it, then pulled away. It wasn't hair. It was something solid, but pliable. Not a wig, more like a carving. I didn't know what it was.
"Is she dead?" I asked.
"She is, isn't she?" But just then the woman took a long, rasping breath. One of her legs twitched.
"Help me turn her over," Butch said.
I took one of her legs, trying to ignore that weird pliability. A thought, Gumby, shot through my head like a meteor and was gone. Butch grabbed her shoulder. We rolled her. Even in the dark we could see she was young, pretty, and ghastly white. We could see something else as well. It was the face of a department store mannequin, smooth and unlined. The eyes were shut. Only her lids had color. They looked bruised. "This is not a human being," I thought. She took another rasping breath. It seemed to catch in her throat as if on hooks when she exhaled. She didn't take another one. I think I would have stayed where I was, frozen, and let her die. It was Butch who saved her. He dropped to his knees, used 2 fingers to yank down her jaw and put his mouth on hers. He pinched her nose shut and breathed into her. Her chest rose. Butch turned his head to one side, spat, and took another deep breath. He blew into her again, and her chest rose again. He lifted his head and stared at me bug-eyed.
"It's like kissing plastic," he said, then did it again.
While he was bent over her, the woman's eyes opened. She looked at me through the bristles of Butch's buzz cut. When Butch pulled back, she took another of those rasping, guttural breaths.
"The kit," Butch said. "EpiPen. Inogen, too. Hurry, fucking run!"
I swayed on my feet and for a moment thought I was going to faint. I slapped myself to clear my head, then ran for the cabin.
"She, it, whatever it is, will be dead when I get back," I thought. I told you, none of this ever escaped my memory. That's probably good.
The first aid kit was just inside the door, with our packs on top of it. I shoved them aside and opened it. There were 2 fold-out drawers, 3 EpiPens in the top one. I took 2 of them and rammed the drawers shut, pinching my right index finger in the process. That nail turned black and fell off, but at the time I didn't even feel it. My head was throbbing. I felt like I had a fever. The Inogen oxygen bottle with the attached mask and the controller was in the bottom, along with flares, rolls of bandage, gauze pads, a plastic splint, an ankle brace, various tubes and ointments. There was also a pin light.
I took that as well and sprinted back down the path with the light swinging back and forth in front of me. Butch was still on his knees. The woman was still giving intermittent gasps for breath. Her eyes were still open. As I dropped to my knees beside Butch, she stopped breathing again. He bent, sealed his mouth over hers, and pushed breath into her, raised his head and said, "Thigh! Thigh!" "I know, I took the course." "Then do it!" He gulped another breath and went at her again. I popped the cap on the epi, put it against her thigh. It looked like corduroy pants, but it wasn't. It was her thigh. And listened for the click. Then I counted to 10. At 5, she gave a hard jerk. "Hold on, Laird. Hold it." "I'm holding it. Do you think I should use the other one?" "Save it. She's breathing again." "Whatever she is. Christ, the taste of her is so weird. Like one of those see-through slip covers you put on furniture. Have you got the oxygen?" "Right here." I gave him the mask and bottle. He held the mask over her mouth and nose. I hit the power switch on the controller and saw the green light. "High flow?" "Yeah, yeah, shoot the works." I saw a drop of sweat from his forehead hit the plastic mask and run down the side like a tear. I pushed the slider all the way to high flow. Oxygen began to hiss. On high, the oxy would last for no more than 5 minutes. And while there were backups of almost everything in a kit, there was a reason it was so heavy, this was the only Inogen. We stared at each other across her. "This is not a human being," I said. "I don't know what it is. Maybe some top-secret cyborg, but it's not human." "It's not a cyborg." He jerked his thumb at the sky. When the oxy ran out, Butch removed the mask and she, might as well call her that, kept breathing on her own. The rasp quieted. I shone the light on her face and she closed her eyes against the glare. "Look," I said. "Look at her face, Butchie." He looked, then looked at me. "It's different now." "It's more human now, is what you mean. And look at her clothes. They look better, too. More jeepers. More realistic." "What do we do with her?" I snapped off the light. Her eyes opened. I said, "Do you hear me?" She nodded. "Who are you?" She closed her eyes. I shook her shoulder, and my fingers no longer sank in. "What are you?" "Nothing." I looked at Butch. "Let's take her to the cabin," he said. "I'll carry her. Keep that other EpiPen ready if she starts to choke and rasp for breath again." He got her in his arms. I helped him to his feet, but he carried her easily enough once he was upright. Her dark hair hung down, and when the breeze gusted, it blew the way normal hair does. The clumping was gone. I had left the cabin door open. He carried her in, put her on the sofa, then bent over with his hands on his knees, getting his breath back. "I want my camera. It's in my pack. Will you get it?" I found it wrapped in a couple of T-shirts and gave it to him. The woman, now she almost did look like a woman, was looking up at him. Her eyes were washed out blue, like the knees of old denim pants. "Smile pretty," Butch said. She didn't smile. He took her picture anyway. "What's your name?" I asked. No response. Butch took another picture. I leaned forward and put my hand on her neck. I thought she might pull away, but she didn't. It looked like skin, unless you looked closely, but it didn't quite feel like skin. I held my hand there for maybe 20 seconds, then took it away. "She has no pulse." "No?" He didn't sound surprised, and I didn't feel surprised. We were in shock. Our processing equipment overloaded. Butch tried to slide his hand into the right front pocket of her corduroy pants and couldn't. "Not a real pocket," he said. "None of it is. It's like a costume. I think she's a costume." "What do we do with her, Butch?"
"Fucked if I know."
"Call the police?" He lifted his hands and then dropped them, a very un-Butch-like gesture of indecision.
The closest phone is Brownie's store. That's miles from here. And Brownie closes at 7. I'd have to carry her across the bridge to the jeep.
I'd take a turn, I said this stoutly enough, but I kept thinking of how my fingers had sunk into what looked like boots and weren't.
It would mean testing the bridge again, he said. As for moving her, she's stable now, but...
What? What are you smiling about?
I gestured to the woman, what looked like a woman, on the couch. She has no pulse, Butchie. She's clinically dead. You can't get much more stable than that.
But she's breathing, and she's...
He checked to make sure.
She's looking at us.
Listen, lad, are you prepared to be on the front page of every newspaper and the lead story on every TV station, not just in Maine or the U.S., but in the whole round world? Because if we take her out, that's what it'll come to. She's an alien. She came from outer fucking space. And not with a lust for Earth women, either.
Unless she's a lesbian, I said.
Then she might, you know, lust for Earth women. We started laughing the way you do when you're trying not to go crazy. She was still looking at us. No smile, no frown, no expression of any kind. A woman who wasn't a woman, who had no pulse but was breathing, who was wearing clothes that weren't clothes but looked more like clothes all the time. I had an idea that if Butch tried her pocket now, his hand would go in. He might even find some change or a half-used roll of lifesavers. Why did she end up on the bridge? What do you suppose happened to her?
I don't know. I think...
I never heard what he thought. That was when light flooded in the east-facing window of our cabin's main room. Thoughts came to me, knocking each other over like dominoes. The first was that time had slipped somehow, and the sun was coming up. The second was that sunrise was never that bright in our cabin because there were too many trees on that side. My third was that some government organization had come for the woman, and those were searchlights. The fourth was that someone had come for her, all right, but it wasn't the government. The light grew brighter still. Butch squinted and raised a hand to shield his eyes. I did the same. I wondered if we were taking a hard dose of radioactivity. Just before the room grew so bright that my vision whited out, I looked at the woman on the couch. Remember me saying that, like old René Lacasse, these pictures never escaped my memory? There's one exception to that. I can't remember what I saw when I looked at her in that awful brilliance. Or maybe I blocked it out. Either way, I don't think I was looking at her at all. I think I was looking into her. As to what I saw, I can remember thinking just one word. Ganglia. I covered my eyes. No good. The light shone straight through my hands and through my closed lids. There was no heat, but it was going to burn my brains to a cinder just the same. I heard Butch scream. That was when I lost consciousness, and I was glad to go. When I came to, the awful brilliance was gone. So was the woman. Sitting on the couch where she'd been was a young man, maybe 30, probably younger, with neatly combed blonde hair, the part as straight as a ruler. He was wearing khaki pants and a quilted vest. A small shoulder bag hung at his side from a strap across his chest. My first thought was he was an out-of-state hunter, a flatlander with ammo in his bag and a scoped rifle nearby. Probably not, was my second one. We had half a dozen battery-powered lamps, and he'd turned them all on. They gave plenty of light, but nothing like that unearthly, literally, glare that had invaded our cabin earlier. How much earlier was a question I couldn't answer. I wasn't even sure it was the same night. I looked at my watch, but it had stopped. Butch sat up, looked around, saw me,
saw the newcomer. He asked a question that was both mad and, under the circumstances, completely logical. "Are you her?"
"No," the young man said. "That one is gone."
I tried for my feet and made it okay. I didn't feel hungover or dazed. If anything, invigorated. And while I'd seen a dozen movies about evil invaders from space, I didn't feel that this young man meant us any harm. Nor did I believe he was actually a young man any more than the woman from the bridge had been a young woman. There was a pitcher of water and 3 leftover cans of beer in our little cold box. I debated and took a beer.
"Give me one," Butch said. I tossed it and he caught it one-handed.
"What about you, sir?" I asked.
"Why not?"
I gave him the last can. Our visitor looked normal, like any young man on a hunting trip with his friends or his dad, but I was still careful not to touch his fingers. I can write what happened, but as to how I felt, much more complicated. All I can do is reiterate that I didn't feel threatened, and later on Butch said the same. Of course, we were in shock.
"You're not human, are you?" Butch said.
The young man opened his beer.
"No."
"But you're in better shape than she was."
"That one was badly hurt. You saved her life. I think it was what you call luck. You could just as easily have injected her with something that would have killed her."
"But the EpiPen worked," I said.
"Is that what you call it? Epi? EpiPen?"
"Short for epinephrine, so I guess it was an allergy that knocked her down."
"Could have been a bee sting," Butch said and shrugged. "Do you know what bees are?"
"Yes. You also gave her your breath. That was the actual saving. Breath is life. More than life."
"I did what we were taught. Laird would have done the same."
"I like to think that was true."
The young man took a sip of beer. "May I take the can when I go?"
Butch sat on the arm of one of our 2 old easy chairs.
"Well, old man, you'll be robbing me of the nickel deposit, but under the circumstances, sure. Only because you're from another planet, you understand."
Our visitor smiled the way people do when they understand it's a joke but don't get the point of it. He had no accent, certainly not a Down East twang, but I got the clear sense of a man who was speaking a learned language. He opened his bag. There was no zipper. He just ran his finger down its length and it opened. He popped a bud can inside.
"Most people wouldn't have done what you did. Most would have run away."
Butch shrugged.
"Instinct. And a little training, I guess. Laird and me are in the local volunteer fire department. Do you get that?"
"You halt combustion before it can spread."
"I guess that's one way of putting it."
The young man dipped into his bag and brought out something that looked like a spectacle case. It was gray, with a silver shape like a sine wave embossed on the lid.
He held it in his lap. He repeated, "Most people wouldn't have done what you did. We owe you for Yella."
Y-L-L-A. I knew that name, and although he pronounced it Yella, I knew the correct spelling, and I could see by his eyes that he knew I knew. That's from the Martian Chronicles. "But you're not from Mars, sir, are you?" He smiled.
"Not at all. Nor are we here because we lust for Earth women."
Butch put his beer down carefully, as if a hard bump might shatter the can. "You're reading our minds."
"Sometimes. Not always. It's like this."
With one finger, he traced the wave shape on the gray case.
"Thoughts don't matter to us. They come. They pass. They are replaced by others. Ephemera. We are more interested in the engine that drives them. To intelligent creatures, that is what's central, powerful, meaningful. I don't know the correct word. Perhaps you don't have one."
"Primal," I said. He nodded, smiled, and sipped his beer.
Yes. Primal. Good.
Where do you come from? Butch asked.
It doesn't matter.
Why? I asked. Why do you come?
That's a more interesting question, and because you saved Yella, I will answer it. We gather.
Gather what? I asked, and thought of stories I'd read and seen on TV about aliens kidnapping folks and sticking probes up their asses. People?
No. Other things.
Items?
But not like this. He reached into his bag and showed us his empty beer can. This is special to me, and means nothing. There's a good word for it. Perhaps French? A veneer?
Souvenir, I said.
Yes, it is my souvenir of this remarkable night. We visit yard sales.
You're joking, I said.
They are called different things in different places. In Italy, vendita in cantiera. Samoan, fanua, fa'ata'u. We take some of these things to remember, some to study. We have film of your Kennedy's death from rifle shot. We have an autographed picture of Judge Judy.
Wait, Butch was frowning. Are you talking about Judge Judy?
Yes, Judge Judy. We have a picture of Emmett Till, a young man with his face gone. Mickey Mouse and his club. We have a jet engine that came from a repository of discarded objects.
They're dump pickers, I thought. Not much different from René Lacasse.
We take these things to remember your world, which will be gone soon. We do the same on other worlds, but there aren't many. The universe is cold. Intelligent life is rare.
I didn't care how rare it was. How soon will ours be gone? Do you know? Or are you only guessing?
And before he could reply,
you can't know. Not for sure.
It may be what you call a century if you are, as you say, lucky, which is only an eye blink in the sweep of time.
I don't believe that, Butch said flatly. We've got our problems, but we're not suicidal.
Then, perhaps thinking of Buddhist monks who had been setting themselves on fire in Vietnam not so long ago.
Not most of us.
It's inevitable, the young man said. He looked regretful. Maybe he was thinking of the Mona Lisa or the pyramids, or maybe just of no more beer cans, no more autographed pictures of Judge Judy. When intelligence outraces emotional stability, it's always just a matter of time. He pointed to the corner of the cabin. Your children playing with weapons. He stood up. I must go. This is for you, a gift. Our way of saying thank you for saving Yella.
He held out the gray case. Butch took it and looked it over. I don't see how to open it.
I took it.
He was right. There was no hinge and no lid.
Breathe on the wave, the young man said. Not now, after I've gone. We give you a key of breath because you gave Yella yours. You gave her part of your life.
This is for both of us? I asked.
Only Butch had given the woman mouth to mouth, after all.
Yes.
What does it actually do?
There is no word for what it does except primal, a way to use what you are not using because of.
He bent forward, brow furrowed, then looked up.
Because of the noise in your lives, because of your thoughts. Thoughts are pointless, worse, dangerous.
I was bemused. Does it grant wishes? Like in a fairy tale?
He laughed, then looked surprised, as if he hadn't known he could laugh.
Nothing can give you what isn't already there. This is axiomatic.
He went to the door, then looked back.
I'm sorry for you. Your world is a living breath in a universe that is mostly filled with dead lights.
He left. I waited for the light to flood in, but it didn't. Except for the gray case Butch was now holding, the whole interlude might never have occurred.
Leia, did that actually happen?
I pointed to the case. He smiled. The reckless one that went right back to when we were kids, racing up and down the suicide stairs in Castle Rock, feeling them shake beneath our pounding sneakers.
Want to try it?
There's an old saying, beware of Greeks bearing gifts.
Yeah, but...
what the hell? I'm game. Blow your precious primal breath, Butchie. He smiled, shook his head, and held the case out.
After you. And if it kills you, I promise to take care of Sheila and Mark.
Mark's almost old enough to take care of himself, I said. Okay. Open sesame. I blew gently on the wave. The case opened. It was empty. But when I breathed in, I caught a faint whiff of peppermint. I think that was it. The case closed by itself. There was no line where the lid met the body, and indeed no hinges. It looked completely solid.
Nothing?
Butch said. Nothing. You try. I held it out to him. He took it and breathed gently on the wave. The case popped open. He bent down, took a timid sniff, then a deep breath. The case shut.
Wintergreen?
I thought peppermint, but I guess they're about the same.
So much for Greeks bearing gifts, he said. Leia, it wasn't some kind of a hoax, was it? You know, like some girl and some guy pretending to be, you know, a trick.
He stopped.
No, huh?
No. He put the gray case on the end table next to his drawing pad.
What are you going to tell Sheila?
Nothing, I guess. I'd prefer it if my wife didn't think I've gone crazy. He laughed. Good luck with that. She can read you like a book. He was right, of course. And when Sheila pushed, which she did, I told her no, we hadn't gotten lost. We'd had a close call in the woods. Some hunter had fired at what he thought was a deer, and the bullet went between us. We never saw who it was, I told her. And when she asked Butch, he backed me up. He said it had probably been some out-of-state flatlander. Butch had seen a couple, so that much was true. Butch yawned. I'm going to bed. You can sleep? Then I yawned, too. What time is it, anyway? Butch looked at his watch and shook his head.
Stopped. Yours?
Yes, and... I yawned again. It's a wind-up. Should be fine, but it's not.
Leia, what we breathed in, I think it was some kind of sedative. What if it's poisonous?
Then we'll die, I said. I'm going to bed. That was what we did. I had a dream of fire. It was full daylight when I woke up. Butch was in the kitchen part of the main room. The coffee pot was on the stove, huffing away. He asked how I felt. Okay, I said. You?
Fine as paint, whatever that means. Coffee?
Yes, and we ought to go see if the bridge is still there. If it is, we'll get going. Show up earlier than planned.
Which we do some years anyway, he said and poured.
Black coffee, rich and strong. Just a thing after an encounter with creatures from another world. By daylight, it all should have seemed hallucinatory, but it didn't. Not to me. And when I asked Butch, he said the same. The Wonder Bread was gone, but there were a couple of fruit pies left. I imagined Sheila shaking her head and saying that only men in the woods would eat Hostess fruit pies for breakfast.
Good, Butch said, munching.
Yes, excellent. Did you have dreams from that stuff we breathed in, Butchie?
Nope, he considered. At least not that I remember. But look at this.
He picked up his pad and flipped past the pictures he'd drawn during our evenings, the usual sketches and caricatures, including one of me with a big grin on my balloon head flipping flapjacks in a skillet. Near the back, he stopped and held the pad up to me. It was our young visitor from the previous night. Blonde hair, vest, khaki pants, shoulder bag. It was no caricature. It was that man. Might as well call him that. To the life, with one exception. Butch had filled his eyes with stars.
Holy shit, that's terrific, I said. How long have you been up, anyway?
About an hour. I did that in 20 minutes. I just knew what to do, like it was already there. Never changed a single line. Crazy, right?
Crazy, I agreed.
I thought of telling him I'd dreamed about a burning barn. It had been incredibly vivid. I'd tried several different ways to get into a story about a freak storm I'd been playing with for quite a while. Years, actually. It had originally occurred to me when I'd been about the age my son was now. I'd try this character, then that character, then some overview of the town where I wanted to set the thing. Once I even tried kicking things off with a weather bulletin. Nothing worked. I felt like a guy trying to open a safe when he's forgotten the combination. Then, this morning, courtesy of my dream, I saw a bolt of lightning hitting a barn. I saw the weather vane, a rooster, turn red with the heat as fingers of fire spread down the barn's roof. I thought everything else would follow. No, I knew it. I picked up the thing that looked like a spectacle case from where we'd left it the previous night, and tossed it from hand to hand. "This did it," I said, then tossed it to Butch. He caught it and said, "Sure, what else?" All that was over 40 years ago, but the passage of time has never caused me to believe my recollection of that night is faulty. Doubt has never crept in, and the pictures have never escaped my memory. Butch remembered it as well as I did. Yella, the light, passing out, the young man, the spectacle case. That case, so far as I know, is still in the cabin. We went out there a few more Novembers before Butch headed west, and each took a turn blowing on the embossed wave, but the case never opened for us again. Nor will it open for anyone else, I'm sure. Unless someone has stolen it, why would they? It's still on the mantle of the fireplace, where Butch put it the last time we were there. The final thing Butch said to me before we left the cabin that day was that he didn't want to draw on his pad anymore, at least not for a while. "I want to paint," he said. "I have 1,000 ideas. I had only one, the burning barn that became the first scene in the lightning storm, but I felt sure others would follow. The door was open. All I had to do was walk through it. Sometimes I'm haunted by the idea that I'm a fake. Before he died, Butch said the same in several interviews. Is that surprising? I don't think so. We were one thing when we went into the woods in the fall of 1978. We were something else ever after. We became what we became. I suppose the question has to do with talent. Was it in us, or was it something given to us, like a box of candy, because we saved Yella's life? Could we be proud of what we accomplished? Kind of a lifting up by the bootstraps deal? Or were we just a pair of poseurs, taking credit for what we never would have had, if not for that night? What the fuck is talent, anyway? I ask myself that question sometimes while I'm shaving or in the old book promotion days while waiting to go on television and sell my latest glut of make-believe or when I'm watering my late wife's daylilies, especially then. What is it, really? Why would I be chosen when so many others try so hard and would give anything to be chosen? Why are there so few at the top of the pyramid. Talent is supposed to be the answer, but where does it come from, and how does it grow? Why does it grow? Well, I tell myself, we call it a gift, and we call ourselves gifted, but gifts are never really earned, are they? Only given. Talent is grace made visible. The young man said, nothing can give you what isn't already there. This is axiomatic. I hold on to that. Of course, he also said he felt sorry for us.
3. Pop's story ended there. Maybe he lost interest in his fantasy version of that hunting trip in 1978, but I don't think so. Those last few lines felt like a climax to me. I pulled a proof copy of The Lightning Storm from the shelf over his desk, maybe the same one I'd looked at not long after my mother's death.
A ragged bolt of lightning struck the barn. It hit with a hollow bang, like the report of a shotgun muffled in a blanket. Jack barely had time to register it before the follow thunder bellowed. He saw the weather vane, an iron rooster, turn red with the heat and begin spinning, even as it sagged and runnels of fire spread down the barn's roof. It didn't match the copy in the handwritten document exactly, but it was close. And better, I thought. Which means nothing, I told myself. He held on to those lines, that image, because it was good. Or good enough, that's all it means. I thought of my mother's call that day in November of 78. That was a lot of years ago, but I was clear on the first thing she said. Something happened to your father while they were on their hunting trip. And to Butch. She didn't want me to come home right away, she said, because both of them were all right, but that weekend, for sure. She said they claimed to have gotten lost, although both of them knew the 30 mile too well for that to happen. Like the back of their hand, I murmured. That's what she said, but I went back to Pop's manuscript.
I told her we had a close call in the woods. Some hunter had fired at what he thought was a deer. The bullet went between us.
Which version was true? According to the manuscript, neither of them. I think that was when I started to believe Pop's story. Or, no, that's not quite right, because it was still too fantastic. But that's where the door opened to belief. Did he ever tell her what he thought was the real story? Was that possible? I thought it was. Marriage is honesty. It's also a repository of shared secrets. He'd only filled half of the spiral notebook. The rest of the pages were blank. I picked it up, meaning to put it back in the bottom drawer, and a sheet of paper fluttered out from between the last page and the back cover. I picked it up and saw it was a receipt from the incorporated town of Harlow, made out to L&D Haulage, a company I'd thought defunct for at least 50 years and maybe longer. L&D had paid property taxes for the years 2010 to 2050 at current 2010 rate for a tract of land bordering on Jalassy Creek in the unincorporated township of TR-90. Paid it in a lump sum. I sat back in Pop's chair, staring at the amount tendered. I think I said, holy fuck. Paying in advance at 2010 rates was probably a terrific deal, but to pay 40 years in advance in a town where most people were behind on their taxes was unheard of. According to this sheet, L&D Haulage, Laird Carmody and Dave LaVergier, in other words, had forked over $110,000. Of course, by then they could afford it, but why? Only one answer seemed to fit. They had wanted to protect their little hunting cabin from development. Why?
Because that otherworldly glasses case was still out there? It seemed unlikely. My guess was scavengers had long since stripped the cabin of anything even remotely valuable. What did seem likely, and now it was a little easier to believe, was that my father and his friend had decided to preserve the location where they had met beings from another world. I decided to go out there. The network of woods roads Pop and Uncle Butch used to get to Jalassi Creek was long gone. There's a housing development and a trailer park there now, both called Hemlock Run. Nor does TR-90 exist. These days, it's the incorporated town of Pritchard, named for a local hero who died in Vietnam. It's still the 30-mile wood on maps and GPS, but now it's just 10 miles of forest, if that. Maybe only 5. The rickety bridge is long gone, but there's another one, narrow but sturdy, a bit further downstream. Its raison d'etre is Grace of Jesus Baptist Church, which sits on the Pritchard bank of the creek. I drove across it and parked in the church lot, although that day the Jalassi was so low I could almost have walked across it had I thought to wear my waders. I made my way back upstream and found the broken stubs of the old bridge sunk deep into weeds and ferns. I turned and saw the path to the cabin, now badly overgrown with bushes and brambles. It was marked by a sign that read, "No hunting, no trespassing, by order of game warden." I went, carefully fearing poison ivy or poison oak, through the bushes. "A quarter of a mile," Pop had written, and I knew from my own trips out here, only a few, I had little interest in shooting creatures that couldn't shoot back. That was about right. I came to a locked gate I didn't remember. There was another sign on it, this one showing a frog over the words, "Hippity hoppity, get off my property." One of Pop's keys opened the gate. I walked around a curve, and there was the cabin. No one had maintained it. The roof hadn't caved in from years of snowfall, probably because it was partially protected by the interlaced branches of old-growth pine and spruce, but it was sway-backed and wouldn't last much longer. The board sides, once painted brown, were now a faded no color. The windows were bleared with dirt and pollen. The place was the very picture of desertion, but it apparently hadn't been vandalized, which I thought was sort of a miracle. Lines of some old poem, probably read in high school, occurred to me. "Weave a circle round him thrice, and close your eyes with holy dread." I found the right key on Pop's ring, and went inside to must and dust and heat. Also to the scribble-scrabble of the current tenants, mice or chipmunks. Probably both. A deck of bicycle playing cards had been scattered across the eating table and on the floor, likely tossed by gusts of wind down the chimney. Once my father and his friend had played cribbage with those very cards. A fan of ash lay in front of the fireplace, but there was no graffiti and no empty cans or liquor bottles. A circle was woven around this place, I thought. I told myself, scolded myself, that I was being ridiculous, but maybe I wasn't. Hemlock Run, both parts of it, was close. Surely kids would have explored this far into the woods, and surely hippity-hoppity get off my property wouldn't have kept them away. But it seemed they had kept away. I looked at the sofa. If I sat on it now, dust would puff up in a cloud and mice might flee from beneath, but I could imagine a young man with blonde hair sitting there, a stranger my Uncle Butch had drawn with stars for eyes. It was easier to believe it had actually happened now that I was out here, in a cabin Pop and Uncle Butch had paid to keep safe, if not sound, until the middle of the century. Much easier. Had either of them come out here again? Possibly to retrieve a case that looked like it might contain spectacles. Not Butch, at least not once he went off to the West Coast. But I don't think my father had either. They were done with it, and although I was Pop's heir, I felt like an intruder. I crossed the room and looked on the mantel, expecting nothing. But the gray case was there, covered by a scrim of dust. I reached for it and winced as I closed my hand around it, as if afraid it might give me an electric shock. It didn't. I wiped away the dust from the top and saw the wave, bright gold embossed on what might have been gray suede. Except it didn't feel like suede, nor did it precisely feel like metal. There was no seam in the case. It was perfectly blank. This has been waiting for me, I thought. It was all true, every word, and this is now part of my inheritance. Did I believe my father's story then? I almost did. And had he left the case for me? The answer to that is more difficult. I couldn't ask the two talented bastards who'd come out here to hunt in November of 1978 because they were both dead. They had made their mark on the world, paintings, stories, and then left it. The young man, who wasn't a man, said the gift was for them, because Pop had shot the knot woman up with the EpiPen, and Uncle Butch had given her his, I quote, precious breath. He didn't say it was just for them, though, did he? And if Pop's breath had opened it, might not mine do it as well? Same blood? Same DNA? Would it open sesame for me? Did I dare try it? What have I told you about myself? Let me see. You know that I was Castle County School Superintendent for many years, before I retired to become my father's amanuensis, not to mention the one who changed his bedding if he wet himself during the night. You know that I was married and my wife left me. You know that on the day when I stood in that decaying cabin, looking at a great case from another world, I was alone. Parents dead, wife gone, no kids. Those are the things you know, but there's a universe of things you don't know. I suppose that's true of every man, Jack, and woman, Jill, on Earth. I'm not going to tell you much, not just because it would take too long, but because it would bore you. If I told you I drank too much after Susan left me, would you care? That I had a brief romance with internet pornography? That I thought of suicide, but never seriously? I will tell you two things, even though both of them embarrass me, almost, but not quite, to the point of shame. They are sad things. The daydreams of men and women of a certain age are always sad, I think, because they run so counter to the plain vanilla futures we have to look forward to. I have some writing talent, as I hope this memoir will show, and I dreamed of writing a great novel, one for the ages. I loved my father and love him still, but living in his shadow became tiresome. I daydreamed of critics saying, "The depth of Mark Carmody's novel makes his father's work look shabby. The pupil has truly outshone the teacher." I don't want to feel that way. Mostly I don't. Yet part of me does, and always will. That part of me is a cave dweller who grins a lot, but never smiles. I can play the piano, but not well. I'm asked to accompany the hymns at the Congo Church only if Mrs. Stanhope is out of town or under the weather. I'm a plodder and a thumper of keys. My ability to read music is on the third grade level. I have polish only on the three or four pieces that I have memorized, and people get tired of hearing those. I daydream about writing that great novel, but it's not the most powerful daydream I have. Shall I tell you what is? Having come this far, why not? I'm in a nightclub, and all my friends are there. My father is, too. The band has left to stand, and I ask if I can play a tune on the piano. The band leader, of course, says yes. My pop groans, "Oh, God, Marky, not bring it on home to me again." I say, with appropriate modesty, "No, I learned something new, and start to play the Albert Ammons classic, Boogie Woogie Stomp. My fingers are flying. Conversation ceases. They stare at me, amazed and admiring. The drummer resumes his seat and picks up the beat. The horn guy starts blowing a dirty alto sax like the one in Tequila. The audience starts to clap along, some of them jitterbug, and when I finish, standing for the final right-hand glissando like Jerry Lee Lewis, they get up on their feet and yell for more. You can't see me, but I'm blushing as I write this. Not just because it's my most treasured fantasy, but because it's so common. All over the world, even now, women are playing air guitar like Joan Jett, and men are pretending to conduct Beethoven's Fifth in their rec rooms. These are the ordinary fantasies of those who would give anything to be chosen and are not. In that dusty, ready-to-fall-down cabin where two men once met a being from another world, I thought I would love to play Boogie Woogie Stomp like Albert Ammons just once. Once would be enough, I told myself, knowing it would not be. It never is. I blew on a wave. A line appeared in the middle of the case, held for a moment, and then disappeared. I stood there for a while, holding the case, and put it back on the mantel. I remembered the young man saying, "Nothing can give you what isn't already there." "It's all right," I said, and laughed a little. It wasn't all right. It stung. But I understood the sting would go away. I'd go back to my life, and the sting would go away. I had my famous father's affairs to tie up. That would keep me busy, and I'd have plenty of money. Maybe I'd go to Aruba. It's all right to want what you can't have. You learn to live with it. I tell myself that, and mostly I believe it. The Fifth Step. Harold Jameson, once chief engineer of New York City's sanitation department, enjoyed retirement. He knew from his small circle of friends that some didn't, so he considered himself lucky. He had an acre of garden in Upper Manhattan that he shared with several like-minded horticulturalists. He had discovered Netflix, and he was making inroads in the books he'd always meant to read. He still missed his wife, a victim of breast cancer 5 years previous. But aside from that persistent ache, his life was quite full. Before rising every morning, he reminded himself to enjoy the day. At 68, he liked to think he had a fair amount of road left, but there was no denying it had begun to narrow. The best part of those days, assuming it wasn't raining, snowing, or too cold, was the 9-block walk to Central Park after breakfast. Although he carried a cell phone and used an electronic tablet, had grown dependent on it, in fact, he still preferred the print version of the Times. In the park, he would settle on his favorite bench and spend an hour with it, reading the sections back to front, telling himself he was progressing from the sublime to the ridiculous. One morning, in mid-May, the weather coolish but perfectly adequate for bench sitting and newspaper reading, he was annoyed to look up from his paper to see a middle-aged man sitting down on the other end of his bench, although there were plenty of empty ones in the vicinity. This invader of Jameson's morning space looked to be in his mid to late 40s, neither handsome nor ugly, in fact, perfectly nondescript. The same was true of his attire. New Balance walking shoes, jeans, a Yankee cap, and a Yankee hoodie with a hood tossed back. Jameson gave him an impatient side glance and prepared to move to another bench. "Don't go," the man said. "Please. I sat down here because I need a favor. It's not a big one, but I'll pay." He reached into the kangaroo pouch of the hoodie and held out a $20 bill. "I don't do favors for strange men," Jameson said and got up. "But that's exactly the point, the two of us being strangers."
Hear me out. If you say no, that's fine, but please, hear me out. You could...
He cleared his throat, and Jameson realized the guy was nervous. Maybe more, maybe scared.
You could be saving my life.
Jameson considered, then sat down, but as far from the other man as he could while still keeping both butt cheeks on the bench.
I'll give you a minute, but if you sound crazy to me, I'm leaving. And put your money away. I don't need it, and I don't want it.
The man looked at the bill as if surprised to find it still in his hand, then put it back in the kangaroo pouch. He put his hands on his thighs and looked down at them instead of at Jameson.
I'm an alcoholic. 4 months sober. 4 months and 12 days, to be exact. Congratulations, Jameson said.
He guessed he meant it, but he was even more ready to get up. To leave.